Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also on Sportsnet Television as well. Show Ali, Nick Ashbourne, fill in for Blake Murphy. He's back on Thursday. Nick, how's it going?
It's good. Happy to be back with you. Happy to be in the, you know, the big fancy studio. Yeah. Feels like a step up. It's a new experience today instead of kind of rolling with it the same way as yesterday where we spent quite a bit of time doing Jays Talk. Yeah, now we're here in the cathedral of Sportsnet Studios.
Yeah, it's fun to be able to do the show with you, certainly live and in color. It's nice to be on with you, certainly on Jays Talk Plus. And the Blue Jays, it's certainly a lot of things going well, a lot of things nice for the Blue Jays right now. I guess they're on a 5-6 question mark game winning streak. Where are you at on, before we get really deep into the weeds on some things, where are you at on the June 26th game, which they won, now being applied to the winning streak they're at now? I have a hard time not including it, but technically it's not a part of the winning streak, but I'm curious where you fall on that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be an optimist, you could say this team is so good, they're going back in time and winning ball games. And honestly, that's what they're going to need to make the playoffs, realistically. If they can get back to April or May and win a few ball games, then they're going to be in the thick of the race. But in terms of the time travel angle, realistically, it wore on me a little bit as that game went on, like hearing that guys were making their Blue Jays or MLB debuts, and we know that simply is not the case. The Jansen thing was kind of fun because it was something that had not happened in the history of baseball. You know, we know the sport has been going for a long, long time. So it was worth taking a second to note that, but it felt like some of the other gimmicks related to June 26th, maybe I would have taken a pass on.
I admit the oddity of seeing Jano wear a Red Sox uniform, which seems bizarre. I mean, watching him wear literally any other team's uniform still is kind of strange, but, you know, we're enough past the trade deadline that I've kind of come to grips with it. But seeing him wear a Red Sox uniform against the Blue Jays is kind of bizarre. But even with the oddity of the actual game itself, with him being the first player in MLB history to play for both teams, it was pretty funny. And I did admittedly kind of go, oh, it's kind of nice, kind of a nice aspect of it when I saw Varsho walk up to the plate and, you know, pat Jano on the back, and they kind of had a little moment to each other. And then I completely forgot about it for the rest of the game. Like, it lasted approximately 30 seconds, and then the game started, and I thought, oh, yeah, this is just a regular baseball game.
The problem with it is that it was totally conceptual. There's nothing visual for people to look at. So obviously what I'm about to lay out would never have happened. But what I would have liked to have seen would him walk up to the plate in a Blue Jays jersey and then be removed for a pinch hitter and then run back to the dugout and come out in a Red Sox jersey, take his place behind the plate as a catcher. Then that really would have hammered home what was going on there. But instead, the fans at home kind of just need to be told, oh, by the way, he was supposed to be hitting, and he's not, and he's behind the plate, and that just isn't as impactful.
Now that you say that out loud, I in my mind, what you're describing is he would leave and then come back in a different uniform. I just have a mental picture of him just ripping off his Blue Jays uniform and his Red Sox uniform underneath it. I think that would have been far more dramatic and more fun, but sadly unrealistic.
And there would have been dead air if he had to leave. Like, then, you know, Dalton Varsho's got to fill some time. You know, on the radio, we know sometimes you get that moment, you just got to fill a couple minutes. I don't know if Dalton Varsho has it from kind of an improv standpoint to do that. I don't know if we want to test that.
Believe me, I on the radio at least, I am familiar very well with filling airtime, because when that happens in Blue Jays radio games, it's this guy who's filling that time.
You and I had an hour 45
right,
minute rain delay show a few weeks back, was really something.
Hey, we talked about The Sopranos and like TV show. It was great. Anyways,
it was a good time.
The Blue Jays, you know, we get a lot of texts, and I saw lots of people message Blair and Barker on Jays Talk, both after game one and game two of this doubleheader. And I think now that they're on, let's call it a 6-game winning streak. Now that they're on a 6-game winning streak and you're facing a Red Sox team that is really flagging. By the way, the playoff odds for the Red Sox, before when we were doing our show yesterday, the playoff odds were around 24-point-something%. They're now on FanGraphs for the Red Sox after losing two games to the Blue Jays, down to 18%. For the Blue Jays, conversely, the playoff odds after two straight wins over the Red Sox have leapt from 0.2% to 0.4% on FanGraphs. So, you know, dumb and dumber, you're telling me there's a chance? That's where we're at right now. But I am curious, because when you look at all the texts we've gotten, and again, you can certainly text us, 590-590, name and location. You know, you look at what people believe, and I think a lot of people do genuinely believe in the team still having a chance to make the playoffs. And I think that there are now 29 games left in the regular season after two games yesterday. So I suppose it would mean they'd have to go something like 25-4 to get to 90 wins, because they had 65 wins now, right? So 25-4 would get you to 90 wins on the season. That'd probably get you into the playoffs, but who's going to go 25-4 over 29 games? It's a difficult proposition, even for the best teams in the world. But I think for me, judging success on the season will not be by whether or not they make the playoffs, because I think that ship has sailed, but the idea of getting back to 500, which is very attainable, incredibly attainable for them to get back to 500, maybe even finish above 500 at this point, I think would be considered an unequivocal success based on the fact that for much of the season they have existed below the 500 watermark.
That would be a massive success of a team. There's no two ways about it. And I know that there'd be some argument that you're diminishing, you know, your draft position slightly, but it's not like the NBA or the NFL where you're quite as sure about the prospects. Right. Like, these guys are years away. The difference between having the sixth pick and having the 11th pick, I don't think is something you lose too much sleep over. And so if the Blue Jays do that, say they go three games over 500 from here on out, they make it to the end that way, I think it would also say important things about the young players they're bringing along, right? Like, they wouldn't have had that success without, you know, the Loperfidos and the Horwitzes of the world performing well, and maybe Bowden Francis continuing his run. Like, these are the type of things that would lead to that outcome. So more important than the outcome itself is that it would indicate that these guys that are part of the Blue Jays' future are performing at a high level, the major leagues, which most of them are unproven at doing that.
I think, too, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm moving the goalposts on the season, because of course the expectation before the season was that they would make the playoffs and possibly even make some noise. And I know at the beginning of the season, and you and I did some Jays talks during the spring as well. If you recall, Nick, we did the infamous Joey Votto hits a home run on his very first pitch against Zach Wheeler of all people, and then steps on the bat in the dugout. Now here we are, like, not even at the end of the season, he's already retired from Major League Baseball. The season comes at you fast, even over the course of several months. But it is kind of funny to think that way back in the spring, even people would message and say, oh yeah, I think I if you're swapping out X, Y, and Z for A, B, and C, then the Blue Jays are going to make the playoffs. And now here we are, and they're not going to, which is, again, a huge bummer. But I do think that on the whole of the season, after what you saw for so much of the first half of the year, even prior to the All-Star break, even prior to June, it felt like for the most of the season, offense was really lethargic. The pitching wasn't particularly synced, it would seem. And then, you know, one aspect or another, the defense, the offense, anything, the bullpen, certainly it all felt like none of it was really coming together at the same time. And it's not always happening now as well, but you're seeing it more consistently. I think that's why when I look at what would make the season feel better as a whole, for you to feel good going into 2025, the 500 watermark is really what I'm looking at and targeting personally, because let's be honest, it's a little more fun that way.
If you look at holistically, like, this season cannot end as a success for the Blue Jays. They set out to compete. They set out to make the playoffs and potentially win a playoff game or a series, something they've failed to do in years past. So that was the goal. They did not reach the goal. It is a failure. That being said, you can chop up the season a little bit and say this part of it was a miserable failure. You know, like April, May, June, like, that was brutal. And then they reach a trade deadline, and I think most people would agree that they did fairly well at bringing in talent for the guys they had to ship away. They didn't have necessarily the biggest chips to play.
Right.
They got some good talent in. And now that talent, not exclusively that talent, but largely that talent, plus a Vladdy resurgence, which is potentially huge for the future of the franchise if they get him extended, that has created a lot of on-field success. So you have the ugly, really ugly start, and I think you have a kind of a promising trade deadline. And now you have a bit of a promising run of play here too. So again, the whole package is not great. This is not what Blue Jays fans signed up for at the beginning of the season, but you can split it up a little bit and say there are aspects of the season that have gone well for the Blue Jays without losing sight of the fact that this is something of a lost year.
Yeah, and that actually is a good point you bring up, because I think a lot of fans too, if I had to briefly take the pulse of the fan base based on what I see on the calls and the texts, I think a lot of people are somewhat afraid that a positive end to the season will mean that, like, there won't be any change, or there won't be enough change. Let's put it that way, because I think change is coming. Change is coming regardless in the off season, at the very least for the players, right? Because I think you and I have alluded to this many, many times. But you know, the trade deadline, you did a good job in shipping guys out. Well, in the off season, there needs to be more guys brought in, whether it's a new left fielder, a new DH, a new third baseman, perhaps a new first baseman if Vladdy's playing third, another starting pitcher if that's what you want, a backup catcher. Like, there are so many, an entire bullpen essentially. There are a whole bunch of aspects of this team that are going to change, But I do wonder when it comes to the front office, I don't think a lot of fans' feelings on, let's say, Ross Atkins or Mark Shapiro have necessarily changed. And I think a lot of people wonder if maybe, you know, maybe you finish the year one game over 500, two games over 500, which is possible. And again, it's I don't know how likely it is, but even if you finish one game under 500, based on how they were like 10, 11 games under 500 at different points this season, I think people would probably take that. But if that is the consequence of that perhaps is no change in the front office, I do wonder how fans will take that in the offseason.
I'm not sure if that's going to, I don't know if this is the right way to frame it, but okay. I'm not sure this is going to fool ownership per se, right? Like, I think that the top of the pyramid here thinks in very big picture terms. And the big picture term, as I just said before, is that the season was a failure based on the goals they set out. And when you're talking about evaluating the performance of a front office, the front office is going to lay forth reasonable goals for a season or a group of seasons. And you can make the case that the Blue Jays front office has failed to meet those goals. They have not made an impact in the postseason in any of the previous years, even though they have built a pretty strong roster a number of times. I think, weirdly, I think the 2021 team is probably the best team they ever built, sure. Even though that fell just short of the playoffs. 2022, that was a good team as well. 2023, maybe not quite so much. But I find it hard to believe the idea that if ownership is inclined to make a change, and I'm not saying that they necessarily will. I know a lot of people really want that to happen, and they're manifesting that. I'm not sure it's going to happen. But if they're going to make a change, I don't think they're necessarily going to be swayed by like, oh, here's a couple of months of some young guys throwing together a spirited run of baseball when they're trying to prove themselves and they went X games above 500 for a couple of months. Like, that would be a very poor way to evaluate a front office's ability, especially when you talk about these guys who have been in town for a long time at this point. So if that is something that ownership is going to say, oh, wait, no, they actually played quite well in August and September, that would be a pretty poor way to go about it.
To play devil's advocate, the only way I could see the opposite happening is let's say the team finishes with 80 wins. Let's just say, right? Like, they finish with 80 wins and 89 wins would have gotten you into the postseason. So then you're looking at a difference, quote unquote, right? Using your quotes, a difference of 9 wins essentially being what got you into the playoffs and what did not get you into the playoffs. So is being 9 wins worse than last year when they won 89 wins? I mean, can you just chalk up 9 losses to bad luck? Like, maybe, like, truly maybe, right? And I think you could, if that ends up being the margin, because if they were to finish like with 70 wins or something like that, or 74 wins, which they're not going to, right? They have 65 wins now. They're going to finish with more than 70 wins. But if it was really catastrophic and the gap between what got you into the third wild card, let's say, because we're not even talking about winning the division, like getting into the third wild card spot and where they finish. If the gap was so astronomical that you couldn't deny that even bad luck wouldn't have saved you, then I think you're right. Like, I think you're making a decision-making process in a different way. But if the margin actually ends up being really small, that's kind of what we're talking about, having a good run to end the year. I kind of wonder if they won't just fool themselves into thinking, hey, you know what, all things are... It's not our fault. Like, things went awry that we couldn't really control. Like, everyone hitting poorly to start the year and guys getting injured. And hey, we're going to bank on some positive regression again, which is unfortunately what they did going into this year. So I don't think that's going to fly for a lot of people. I'm just saying, I don't think that's going to happen, but I could see that being an argument, which I think scares a lot of people.
The counter argument to that would be, it's going to be hard for this group to say that it was bad luck that led us astray, because a lot of what happened that was wrong with the Blue Jays, and there are some things that are bad luck, like take Bo Bichette's season.
Sure. Yeah.
You can't possibly project that he would be that bad and then injured, a guy who's been consistently good every year and durable, you know, a little bit of issue in 2023, but generally speaking, durable. However, I think where they'd have the issue is, like, you're looking at a team with a negative 60 run differential. This is not the 2015 Blue Jays who had an unimpressive record, but everyone saw, okay, the quality of the team is there, but there have been tough breaks and the bullpen has been, and you know, the bullpen for this group has been brutal,
yeah.
But that's not the whole story by any stretch of the imagination. So when you're talking about a team that is way underwater when it comes to run differential, and a lot of the things that went wrong with this group can be attributed to the offseason that they had, right? Like, they brought in Justin Turner. They brought back Kevin Kiermaier. These guys did not contribute to the Blue Jays winning ball games, and so it's hard for the front office to put their hands up in the air and say, oh, no, what could have possibly happened? Like, if anything, in 2023, I think maybe they could have made that argument,
because
no one thought that Springer would decline the way he would. No one thought that Vladdy would have that season. No one thought that Kirk would go from being an all-star to being kind of a sub-average hitter. Like, 2023 is the year where I think they do have a bit of a mulligan to say, you know what, like, this is kind of crazy. All
and
this
they did
stuff.
Make the playoffs.
And they made the playoffs still, and they made the case that they should run it back to these guys in 2024. And then that now it's like, okay, we can put that to bed. That was not the right call.
Yeah, I do think you're right. When it comes to resource allocation, dollars being allocated to the right or wrong players, I do think you're right. I mean, a lot of people will text in and call in and say, hey, it's not the show. The Blue Jays don't spend money. I don't think that's true. The Blue Jays do spend money. It's about, do they spend money wisely? I think those are two very different conversations, essentially.
And to be honest, there was a time when the team didn't spend money.
Sure,
so, like,
yeah.
This is progress for the franchise writ large. Again, not what people want to hear, because they want to see the money spent wisely, as you say, and that hasn't always been the case. Though in free agency, you could argue there's been some wins there with, Gausman and Bassett and player and Barrios's extension, arguably as well. It has not been like they have been forking, a shovel full of cash into a boiler every single offseason. It's not as grim as some people believe, but there's certainly been some missteps along the way.
Speaking of Barrios, I did want to talk a little bit about two guys that had outsized impacts on both wins yesterday. Certainly Jose Barrios, who went 7 2/3 in 9 innings in the second game of the doubleheader. And then Ryan Yarbrough as well, who pitched, I guess, it was a bullpen day, who pitched the bulk, I guess we can say, of the work against the Boston Red Sox in game one of the doubleheader. I guess traveling back in time to June 26th, before Ryan Yarbrough was a Blue Jay, he still pitched in that game, which is kind of a fun, silly quirk of the whole idea of resuming a suspended game. But I did want to talk about Barrios first. 7 2/3, 8 hits, 3 runs, 2 of which were earned. No walks, 6 strikeouts. He threw 98 pitches. He did give up a home run to Jarren Duran. It's funny, he was 7 1/3 into his outing, and I thought, this is going great. Like, this is going swimmingly. I know he'd given up a run before, but I thought, man, this is what you want. He had not given up a home run yet, and that's kind of been something that's really plagued Barrios this year. He's given up a whack of home runs. I think actually the most in the American League, if not the most in Major League Baseball. So he has given up a lot for a qualified starting pitcher, and then single, I believe, to David Hamilton, and then a moonshot from Jarren Duran, who was an all-star this year. So again, I don't want to blame him entirely, but I do wonder, even with the home run given up, I feel like it was a bit of progress for Barrios, who has had not the same season he had last year and has had a bit of a topsy-turvy season. But again, knowing that the guy's under contract for quite some time to come and he's going to be on the team going forward, period. I mean, even if he's not an ace, he's not even maybe he's like the perfect number three starter in a team's rotation. I think it's a good step forward to see him, I'm using air quotes here, but only give up 3 earned runs over 7 2/3.
Yeah, and this continues a stretch of good starts prior to that, right? Like, he had 7+ innings and 2 or fewer earned runs in the last 3 starts before that. And if you zoom out a little bit, before this last 4 starts, which have been really strong, like, we're talking about 28.2 innings and, 26 strikeouts in that time, when strikeouts have been a big issue for him all season long. Before that, he had a 4.11 ERA, which is pretty uninspired for him, kind of below what you want to see. He had the 7th worst strikeout per 9 among all qualified starters. Like, he was really struggling to get those outs, get those whiffs. Last little bit, it's a lot of it is his signature pitch. It's the slurve. Yeah. And he was really working that in that game. And he's starting to get a few more whiffs. He's starting to look a little bit more like himself. And if you combine some of the things he's done, like, he's done better against left-handed hitters this season, that's always been a huge issue for him. There's warts too, like the home runs you point out. That is a huge issue. If you have home runs and you have a lack of strikeouts, that is, it's a confusing thing. Like, his ERA looks respectable, but if you kind of go under the hood a little bit, everything else is telling you things have been dicey for him at times. Early in the year, he was unbelievable. I remember going on a podcast and someone asked me if he was in the Cy Young race, and I was like, oh, slow your horses, but he's definitely off to a great start. You have to respect it. You've seen this with a lot of the Blue Jays veteran pitchers. There's been some bumps along the way, but at the end of the year, it kind of feels like they're going to end up where you expect. And Barrios is that third starter, as you mentioned. Like, he's on the team for a long time. They're paying him a decent chunk of change, but he's earning that money. He's kind of like, he's not a super efficient use of money. He's not a poor use of money. He's someone that you can rely on. And the durability is there for him, and it's always been there for him. And that is really crucial when you're building a rotation, when you feel like you don't necessarily need as much depth because he's a guy you can trust.
Yeah, Barrios just does not miss starts. That's
absolutely
period.
Not.
Like, period.
Yeah, never has.
Yeah. Like, if you look back to his Twins days, he just doesn't miss time, which is, I think, an underrated aspect of most starting pitchers. Like, most starting pitchers will miss time because of injury X, Y, or Z, for example, right? Even the best pitchers in the world really do. And you brought this up yesterday, but the top three pitchers in the Blue Jays rotation, Gausman, Berríos, and Bassett, none of them really missed a lot of time, which I think has been crucial for a team like the Blue Jays, where especially in 2024, the bullpen has been so poor. And again, yesterday, the bullpen was great in both aspects of those games. But I have been very impressed with what Berríos has been doing recently. And I think it's something, you know, as we talk about 2025 and you think about looking ahead to the next year and like what aspects of this team can carry over to next year and like which position players are we talking about and so on. And from a pitching standpoint, especially from a starting pitching standpoint, knowing that Berríos is going to be on the team unequivocally next year, it is really interesting because I was a little worried about what everyone would look like a year older, and all of them had a bit of a topsy-turvy season, Gausman, Berríos, Bassett. But I mean, if Berríos can find something going into next year, especially the command of that slurve, like he has actually said in post-game interviews, that's his bread and butter. Like he has actually used those words to describe his slurve. And he has said many times this season that the slurve has just not worked. It's not broken to either side as he essentially wants it to. Whereas he's had to rely on the fastball a little more. He's on the sinker a little bit more. He's on the four-seamer a little bit more than he generally has year over year. So I am curious to see if he can retain some more in the last, what, 3-4 starts of this season, if he can retain that command. Because, I mean, him finding it again, much like Gausman finding the splitter and finding the vertical break on the weekend, I mean, those are going to be huge aspects for both those guys going into 2025.
It's absolutely critical. Like, his fastballs are fine at best. Like, he throws kind of like 94 miles an hour. Yeah. It can be a little bit hotter than that. It can be a little bit less than that. But if he was a guy that did not have the superlative breaking pitch, it's an unusual pitch. Like, not a lot of guys throw, you know, people used to call it a curveball, and it was like really horizontally oriented curveball. People are calling it a slurve now. It's a very odd pitch, and it's one of the reasons why he's been successful is that there's just not a lot of guys who have the same repertoire he does. And as you mentioned with Gausman, it's kind of the same thing. Now, Gausman can dial it up a little higher when he's really going, but his velocity is pretty inconsistent too. So these guys are as good as they are because they have this unique tool in their arsenal. Even, you know, Chris Bassett's tool is that he has a ton of tools. His tool is a Swiss Army knife, but it's the same idea. Like, Bassett doesn't blow people away. The Blue Jays don't really have that guy. They don't have that ace guy who throws 97. They don't have prime Gerrit Cole walking through the door. They have these guys who need these other pitches to work. And sometimes that can feel a little bit perilous. Like when Gausman loses his split and, you know, he's working with his slider as his top secondary pitch, like that's not a good situation. When Berríos has to lean on that change up a little bit more, no one really wants to see that. Like, it's not an utterly unworkable pitch, but what makes him extraordinary or what makes him so consistent is this pitch. And so it has been significantly better, as you point out, kind of through August or so, a little bit late July. And he's someone that you talk about the age of these other guys. Like, Berríos is only 30 years old. Like, it seems like he's been around forever, but it's the reason why he's been around forever is because he makes every start and he's been pitching since he was 22. And so he's someone that we used to think of very differently until 2022 happened. And the train went off the tracks in 2022, and suddenly he wasn't the most consistent pitcher in baseball, which is like, that's a title he legitimately earned for most of his career. Now we're a couple years removed from that. And it seems a little bit more fair to sort of throw that one out and think of him again as that guy who is, you know, your prototypical number three, you know, number two on certain teams that have really good offenses, however you want to frame it. As long as that pitch is really, really working and the fastball is, again, in that area of fine, then he's going to be a really solid part of the middle of your rotation.
You mentioned Bassett, who does not necessarily blow guys away. We've seen our fair share of those guys over the years. Hyunjin Ryu, another guy we've seen relatively recently, albeit not on the Blue Jays this season, but another guy who, you know, is I think we refer to a lot of the pitchers like Ryu and Bassett as deceivers, right? Like they get by on guile and deception. And Ryan Yarbrough might be another example of that. Maybe, you know, might is maybe too weak a word. He is another example.
Yeah, when
of
you're
that.
Pounding 87 in there, you're not doing it with deception. No. I mean, you are doing it with deception. You're not blowing anyone away with that.
Yeah, 3 1/3 from Yarbrough yesterday, 2 hits, no runs, 1 walk, 4 Ks. He just threw 51 pitches. But I just find that Ryan Yarbrough experience so much fun because for years when he was a Tampa Bay Ray, Blue Jays fans are very familiar with this, but he just lulls guys to sleep. And then they just, it's almost like they can't help but swing at the slowest pitches you've ever seen. Like, even for Bassett and Ryu, when they were dialing up speed, they're dialing it up to like 91, 92 miles an hour. I don't think I've ever seen Ryan Yarbrough do that. Maybe he'll do it once in a while to 90 miles an hour, but I feel like the hardest pitches you are usually seeing him throw in a game are like 88 miles an hour, but the batters just cannot help themselves from swinging, and he locates so well. I do wonder, Ryan Yarbrough, going to be 33 by the, I think his birthday is in December, so by the beginning of next season, he will be 33. He's 32 right now. Is there room for a 33-year-old Ryan Yarbrough on the Blue Jays next year? Also, by the way, when I looked up his age, I was shocked. Because if you were to ask me how old Ryan Yarbrough was, I would be like, yeah, he's like 39, he's 40. No, the man's 32 years old. So he's younger than I am.
He's in his prime. Yeah. He's ready to go. No, I wonder how hard he's going to be throwing when he's 39. It could be sort of a Mark Burley situation at the end there. Now, the Blue Jays bullpen is exceedingly uncertain for next season. And I'm not going to bang the drum like, you got to bring this guy back. Like, they are certainly seeing the best of him. He is on a bit of a heater right now. But he is the type of pitcher that is always available for relatively cheap. Like, there's just not going to be people, there's not going to be a ton of bidders knocking on his door being like, we have to have Ryan Yarbrough no matter what. We're not leaving without him. Like, he's made between 2.3 and 3.9 million in each of the last four seasons. Some of that was arbitration. Some of that was free agency. Everyone agrees that's the kind of the value. He's someone who eats a bunch of innings for you. It's funny that the Blue Jays have seen the best of him as an opponent and now as their own pitcher. So it'd be easy to overvalue him. Like, he's a guy with a career ERA of 4.29. He's not a star by any stretch of the imagination. But if you use one of your bullpen slots on Ryan Yarbrough, he can give you innings in bulk, and there will be times when you're going to need that. Like, for that, sure. Realistically, that is something most teams can use. So if the Blue Jays explore bringing him back for 2025, I don't think anyone would be against that. It would be, again, almost certainly a one-year deal, almost certainly something they could afford.
Ryan Yarbrough's starts at Tropicana Field were the stuff of nightmares, I think, for a lot of Blue Jays fans for a long time. And now Ryan Yarbrough starts for the Blue Jays, whether it's on the road like Fenway yesterday or at the Rogers Center, I think you're going to be pretty happy, at least for the next month or so in these next 29 games. Let's ask that same question to Ben Nicholson-Smith. He's actually going to join us on the other side. Of course, Ben writes for Sportsnet.ca, co-host of the great At the Letters podcast. He's in Boston, so we'll catch up with Ben on the other side. You're listening to and watching Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Show Adley and Nick Ashbourne here with you. Blake's back on Thursday. Appreciate you all being along with us as the Blue Jays try and make it, I guess, a 7-game winning streak later tonight. They're going to play the third of 5 games, not something you say very often, at Fenway Park in Boston. And in Boston, joining us right now to help us discuss what we saw over 2 games yesterday and certainly what we'll hopefully see going forward is Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet and, of course, co-host of At the Letters, BNS. How's it going, man?
Hey, show. Hey, Nick. How's it going, guys? Pretty good here in Boston so far. A bit of a long day yesterday, but always fun to be at Fenway Park. So, yeah, no complaints here.
Yeah, one of the cathedrals of baseball, actually. I've never been to Fenway, Ben. I'm curious, how many of the cathedrals of baseball have you now been to?
If we're counting, like, the old stadiums,
sure, yeah,
of which there actually aren't that many, yeah, sure. I have been to all of the old stadiums.
Ooh, nice.
So that's, you know, yeah, Wrigley Field. I mean, you run out of old stadiums pretty quick. Dodger Stadium's incredible. The Oakland Coliseum counts, I think, in that age demographic.
Maybe not under Stadium incredible.
No, but certainly under old. So, yeah, I think all the old stadiums I've been to.
Well, at Fenway Park, the Blue Jays certainly have been playing pretty well, certainly in these last couple of games at least. Even if one game technically counts for June 26th, we'll count it, Ben. I do wonder, on the next episode of At the Letters, are you and Arden going to be banging the drum for the Jays making the playoffs? Like, where are you at on playoff odds these days, you and Arden?
Well, I'll tell you this. I think it's funny how this works sometimes, right? Because if they had this streak of 6 wins, let's call it, in May or in June, it would have really reshaped their season, and it would have reshaped how we talk about the Jays. Now, here they are having it in August. They are in last place. They are not in playoff contention. they're going to need a lot more than six wins for that to change. And we're not there now. So I'm not really going to engage with that. But I will say that, I mean, I will engage with it, but I'm not seriously going to engage with it. But in the course of 162 games, you end up where you should. I'll say that.
Ben, one of the guys we talked about a lot kind of in the earlier segment of the show was Jose Berríos and how we evaluate his season, because it's been an odd one, I think, objectively. When you look at what he's done, you know, there's things that you could say are positives. You know, he's done better against left-handed hitters in terms of pure run suppression. He's been pretty effective. He's got a respectable ERA. At the same time, you look at the peripherals, strikeouts have been a problem. Most of the ERA estimators are kind of around 5. Does this season give you more or less confidence in Jose Berríos as a member of the Blue Jays rotation going forward?
I would say a little less, and I know that sounds kind of harsh, but I'm just trying to answer the question. And, when you have less swing and miss, that's just really important, obviously, to sustaining success, to being successful in the major leagues. And that's where, you know, someone like Spencer Schwellenbach comes up with Atlanta, and he starts against the Twins tonight. And I'm kind of like, okay, this guy misses bats. This is a big deal. Someone gradually loses a little bit. You don't necessarily notice it in the same way. It's not as kind of attention grabbing, but swinging strikes are incredibly important in Major League Baseball, especially in the American League East, where you're facing really good hitters in small parks. So I think for Berríos to take a slight step back in that department isn't ideal. Now, at the same time, that's not to say he doesn't do some things really well, and I don't want to overlook what he did last night, where, you know, at a time that the Jays had 3 relievers, 0 established relievers available, Berríos goes out, hauls innings into the 8th. Absolutely incredible performance, and he deserves full credit for that. But this season as a whole, there hasn't been quite as much swing and miss, and that to me is something that I look at.
Yeah, I was definitely sitting on my couch last night, Ben, wondering after we saw both Chad Green and Yenesis Cabrera in game 1, I thought, boy, who's pitching the end of this game? Like, I have no idea who's pitching. Ryan Burr already pitched as well. Zach Pop pitched as well. Like, a lot of the guys who are in the circle of trust, as I like to say, basically none of them were available. So for Berríos to turn in 7 2/3, Brendan Little cashes in his first career save, I thought it was very impressive. You know, Nick and I were talking about Gausman is a part of this as well, but as it pertains to Berríos, the quality of his best pitch and the slur, for example, is his bread and butter. He's said as much himself many times over the last couple of years, but the slurve has been a little wonky. The results off of the slurve in particular have not exactly been there. And it's kind of along the same lines of Gausman's splitter. And over the weekend, the splitter looked pretty darn good. It might have been the best the splitter has looked all season. When you look year over year from this year going into what we might see next year, again, along the same lines of the conversation we're having, are you, I don't want to say worried at all, but how do you view the evolution of those pitches in terms of can they find what makes it one of their, if not their best pitches for pitchers that have really great arsenals, essentially?
Yeah, I think both of those pitches are obviously central to what they're trying to do out there, as you say, show. So no question about that. I think that with Gausman, as he's getting into his later 30s, it's harder to imagine that he's going to get back to like the prime version. Not to say he can't still be useful, not to say he can't still be part of a good team, but it's hard to imagine that he's going to be quite at that level as the Jays move ahead here. So Berríos, I think, is in a different bucket where we've seen him go, and because partly because he's younger, and we've seen him already bounce back from really tough seasons before. Even in 2022, we all know how dismal that season was for Berríos. Then with he's a really hard worker. He's super athletic, even in the context of major league players. Like, he is more athletic than most major league players. And I think that as a starting pitcher who has to repeat his delivery over and over 100 times, 32 times a season, that athleticism helps him and helps him stay in line toward the plate, consistent with his mechanics, and then throwing strikes when he needs to. So I think he has that adaptability and versatility to recover and to adjust as a major league starting pitcher, and we've seen it before. So I do think as the Jays move ahead here, Berríos, despite what I just said to Nick's question, probably is the starting pitcher that you have the most confidence in moving forward.
Moving from the veteran starters to the young guys, Ben, when we invite you on a show like this, I kind of do it from a perspective of just wanting to extract those hot takes. Like, I'm looking for the Skip Bayless of the Blue Jays world. And with that in mind, I'm wondering...
That's me, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what of the young players. And when we say young players, the ages kind of get a little bit ambiguous there when you have Horwitz being older than Vladdy and things like that. But I think I know what you know what I mean when I say the young players. When you look at this Blue Jays cohort of young players, which of them are you most personally bullish on? And maybe we can take Spencer Horwitz out of the equation because he's perhaps established himself in a slightly different category than the rest. Just in terms of the pure Ben, I don't know, gut feel, I'm sure it's informed, but who are you the most bullish on right now?
I'll go with Leo Jimenez on this one. I just think that he's a major league player. And to be up here at 23, already producing, I mean, defensively, he's very smooth out there. He's very controlled. He makes the plays that he should. And that's not easy to do. I mean, we saw the Boston Red Sox yesterday make 6 errors, and they were completely throwing the ball around everywhere. It was sloppy. And every team is going to have its bad days. But I think that Leo Jimenez, in contrast to that, is controlled. He's athletic. And I mean, he's arguably the best defensive shortstop they have. Ernie Clement too has done a good job there. But I think Leo, when you think about 23 years old, that defense and a little bit of hard contact at the plate, the strikeout rate's a little high. Obviously you don't want him striking out 30% of the time, but if he can over time get that to whatever it is, 24%, 23%, then all of a sudden you're talking about someone who can be really helpful on both sides of the ball.
You know, along those same lines, Ben, and we're chatting with Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet.ca, co-host of At the Letters here on Jays Talk Plus show, and Nick here with you until 12 Eastern. You know, I did want to ask about backfilling positions in 2025 from within the roster, I suppose. And again, I think there are a laundry list of needs when it comes to the offseason, right? We've talked about it a little bit in the first segment. Maybe a third baseman, depending on whether or not you want to see Vladdy play it more at third base, as has been some recent reports. Maybe a first baseman, if that's the case. Maybe a new left fielder, maybe a new starting shortstop, maybe a new DH, maybe another starting pitcher, maybe a backup catcher. Like, there are a variety of places we can take this conversation. But of course, the more you backfill from within the organization, the less you have to do in free agency. So I do wonder, you know, Leo Jimenez, I think I agree with you that he's a major leaguer. I think we can probably pencil in Horwitz and Clement into at least bench roles, depending on what they do in free agency next year. But how many positions realistically do you think can be backfilled within the team before they go out and spend, you know, probably a lot of money in free agency next year?
Yeah, I might almost turn that question on its head if you'll allow me.
Sure.
Some show. And I might say, how many positions can they fill in free agency? And then whatever's left All will right. be filled internally. And so if you are trying to fill as many of those positions as you can in free agency or via trade, of course, but I think if they're doing trades, which they obviously will because they always make trades, but if they're making trades, then I think it's more like a hypothetically Addison Barger for a really good reliever. You know, it's David Schneider for a, you know, double A starting pitcher who's got some upside. Like, that's the type of trade that you might endeavor to make, where it's hitter for pitching. But in free agency, let's say you go out and you try to sign Anthony Santander. Great. Okay, that's a good idea. Let's say maybe you also trade Bo Bichette, for argument's sake. Then you're going to try to backfill. Maybe you try to sign Willy Adames. And great, those are good players. But maybe Anthony Santander doesn't want to sign with the Blue Jays for whatever reason. Or the Jays hold firm to their values, as they have done many times before. And they say, we value you at, throwing numbers out there, $64 million over 4 years. And he's got an offer out there for $100 million. Well, he's not going to be a Blue Jay. So at that point, then you haven't filled those needs in free agency. Maybe you end up relying a bit more on the young players who are now emerging. But to me, this is an offseason where the Jays need to be aggressive in free agency if they are going to have any chance of competing next year. Obviously connects to a lot of different factors when we start talking about offseason planning. And they have a lot of work to do on that front because they're not where they need to be, despite everything that's happened and gone well in these 6 games.
The only reason I really bring it up, Ben, is because I wonder, you know, we saw Baden Frantz almost throw a no-hitter on the weekend. And, you know, I think a part of that conversation was, well, if Baden Frantz can play, if, you know, now he's not taking a no-hitter into the 9th inning to be considered good going forward, obviously. But if Baden Frantz is a part of the solution in the starting rotation next year, and I think there's at least a chance he is, then in theory, it means of all the laundry list of positions you need to improve at, like, in theory, you can now allocate resources, more resources, maybe the better way of saying it is, to another position, if that makes sense, right? Like, you don't need to go out and spend, in theory, top dollar on like the fourth or fifth starter in the 2025 rotation. And instead, maybe you can offer a Santander or a Tyler O'Neill or a Teoscar Hernandez like a teensy bit more money, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, for sure it does. And I think Teoscar would make sense on this team. Tyler O'Neill on a team that has a lot of left-handed hitters, a lefty masher like O'Neill. I mean, there's some intrigue there. I think at the same time, if you're the Jays, you have to be looking for a starting pitcher. And I don't know exactly what tier they end up shopping in, but man, like I think from Blake Snell and Corbin Burns all the way down, you have to at least consider that. And I'm not predicting the Jays actually do that, but they don't have enough starting. It would be great. They just, you know, they have a lot of needs. I don't see them, you know, spending top dollar on a free agent starting pitcher this offseason. But, you know, it all connects to what is their overarching plan. And we believe, based on the comments that Mark Shapiro made earlier this month, the Blue Jays seem to want to contend next year and to be competitive in 2025. And there are reasons for that. But there's also the question of, is Vlad Jr. going to be extended? What kind of money do the Jays have to spend? So these sorts of things are going to impact what that overall plan looks like.
Ben, in terms of that plan, one thing that's been getting a lot of oxygen lately is the idea that there might be more than spot starts at third base for Vladdy. I don't know about a full conversion, but there's been talk that we're going to see more and more of him down the stretch. Do you think that there's a world where next season they go out and get an elite type first baseman and push Vladdy to third, and that's the type of alignment that they're comfortable going with, if not all of the time, then a significant portion of the time? Or do you think that this is a storyline that's kind of bubbled up now, you know, in the end run of the season, and it's something we're less likely to hear that much about in 2025?
So I love the idea of getting Vladdy reps at third base, and I've always thought that that was a good idea, just to build versatility in game. And week to week, you never know if someone might get hurt or you might want to use that option. So I think it's a good thing to have him over there. But to me, I have yet to hear the argument, I'll put it that way, that really convinces me that it's a good idea to plan on him being a third baseman next year. And, you know, you could have Pete Alonso, let's say, or Christian Walker. Those are the two big first basemen who are out there, and they're good hitters, but they're getting into their 30s, especially Walker. He's entering his mid-30s. And so, you know, he's a good defender now. Do you project him to be a good defender in a couple of years? What does that mean for your overall roster composition? Even Pete Alonso, he's obviously a really, really good hitter, but you're talking over $100 million, and it doesn't necessarily make you a good defensive team. If you have Alonso at first and you have Vlad at third, I just don't think you're doing your pitching staff any favors. Whereas Vladdy at first, very, very capable, and then at third base, you know, if you've got the money to go out and spend, let's call it $150 million to sign Pete Alonso, well, maybe you can get Willy Adames for $105 million. And to me, that's a better deal. And you put Adames at third or at short, depending on how things shake out with the Bichette situation. And then you have an offensive upgrade that's not quite as big, but you're actually improving your overall defense of the team and your versatility and your flexibility. So, and you're spending less. So to me, that would be a more appealing option.
I think Willy Adames might be, if I had to pick just one free agent, and you hope there are multiple free agents the Blue Jays bring in, Willy Adames might be at the top of my wish list, Ben, honestly. Even beyond a Teo or a Tyler O'Neill or a Santander. I mean, you know what? I take it back. Juan Soto's at the top of my wish list. But then after Juan Soto, I'm going to say Willy Adames. But it's interesting because Nick had brought this up yesterday when we were talking about the report from Bob Nightingale of USA Today that the Blue Jays were exploring more third base starts, certainly down the stretch, but in 2025 as well for Vladdy. And I found it interesting because the point Nick brought up was simply that you essentially, in order to make that happen, you essentially need to find more value at first base than you're giving up at third base if Vladdy is the third baseman going forward, if that makes sense, right? Like if you're sacrificing a little bit on the defensive end, you need to make it up with offense at first base, which is why Pete Alonso makes a lot of sense, because Pete Alonso might be one of the best power hitters in all of baseball, certainly at first base. But it's like you mentioned, I mean, if you're talking about the free agent crop, and it's hard to predict trades, so I'll only look at the guys who we think will be free agents in the offseason, but it's Pete Alonso and Christian Walker, like you said. Rhys Hoskins can opt out, and we'll see if he does, but he wouldn't be a bad solution either. But, I mean, after that, it's like Paul Goldschmidt, it's Josh Bell, it's Carlos Santana. And I think if, like, you're going in – yeah, I see you shaking your head. Like, if you go into next season with any of Goldschmidt, Bell, or Santana as your starting third first baseman and Vladdy at third, it's going to remind a lot of people of, like, the Justin Turner situation or the Brandon Belt situation. It's going to remind people of, like, the Leafs signing, like, Jason Spezza and Joe Thornton at the end of their careers. You know what I mean? Like it's going to smack more of that than it would, I think, selling people on, hey, this is actually a much improved version of first and third base.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's kind of a threshold where if you're really talking about moving one of your cornerstone players, that new player had better be really, really good. Yeah. And that's where, you know, around Bichette, this is going back a few years, but the conversation was like, hey, for maybe Lindor, maybe for a Bogarts, right, maybe for, you know, let's say Trey Turner, but you're not going to do that for like Freddie Galvis, right? Yeah. So
even for Dansby Swanson, think, that was a conversation, if you remember, right? And I think you're seeing that now with Dansby Swanson's production.
Yeah, I think, you know, with Vlad Jr., to me too, if he's at third base and he's helping his team out and he's contributing a couple days a week or once a week over at third, and you know, then that to me has like MVP vibes, where like he's just going over there and he's doing it for the good of the team. If you put Vladdy over there 6 days a week and you're exposing him potentially defensively at a position that he has never fully mastered, then all of a sudden is the vibe like Vlad Jr.'s defense is not that great, right, and he's somehow like letting the team down. I just think you got a good thing going with him. He's an MVP tier player. I'm not saying he's going to win this year. He obviously won't, but he's an MVP tier player. And I just don't think you need to mess with that. I think there are other issues and areas on the roster that you can play around with and get really flexible with. And to me, Vladdy, first baseman, hits 300, hits 30 homers and has an OPS of 900. That's an incredible, incredible player. And we don't really need to adjust that.
One angle of the Vladdy at third base idea is the contractual angle, right? I mean, everything seems to boil down to his contract at this point because there's so many people concerned that he won't remain a Blue Jay or wondering what that will cost. Do you think there's a world where if he plays, I don't know, 15 games at third base down the stretch, I don't know the exact number, and looks good doing it, that's something that he can use in contract negotiations and say, like, I have third base utility. Maybe you're not playing me there every day. Maybe you're not saying I'm your starting third baseman, but I can be a third baseman, and that brings more value. Do you think that could have an effect on the negotiations?
I don't think it hurts. I don't think it hurts. I think at the same time, like in these negotiations, and I don't know, I'm sort of like, I'm imagining this to an extent here, but to me in these negotiations, like Vlad Jr.'s leverage is just, he's 1 year away from free agency. He's 25 years old and he's a monster at the plate. And I think that that combination alone gives him huge leverage. I think that he has way more leverage than the Blue Jays. I think that the time of to do an extension where you have quote unquote shared risk has totally passed the Blue Jays by. And that's okay. That's fine. As a big market team, they can withstand that risk. They can pay that price. And that might be exactly what they end up doing. And that's fine. But I don't think that Vlad Jr. has to do anything other than hit and stay healthy to make sure that he has good negotiating power. He doesn't have to say anything more, doesn't have to do anything more, smile anymore, play any more third base. The bat does the negotiating.
Ben, look, we're going to let you run, man. I appreciate you doing this for us. You're the man. I love catching up with you. Best of luck with the coverage at Fenway. Enjoy the cathedral later today, and I will see you back in Toronto.
Thanks so much, guys. Talk soon.
There he goes, Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet.ca and, of course, co-host of the great At the Letters podcast with Arden Zwelling. We got a couple minutes left here before we go in on the other side chat to Chris Cotillo from MassLive.com. Get the Red Sox angle, and I do want to ask Chris a little bit about some of the shaky defense we saw, and maybe he watches the Red Sox far more than we do. Is that something that's been a plague for them this year, or is it just a one-off? Talk to Chris about the Red Sox on the other side. But Vladdy's contract is going to be something we talk about, Nick, like essentially until it gets done, either until he leaves the Jays in free agency or until he re-signs a big contract extension. I tend to believe it will get done. But I there is probably an upper limit. Like every home run he hits is not going to add like $5 million to the total, but I do wonder if you've settled on there being a good, if not perfect, comp or expectation for what might happen in the end? Because Rafael Devers is the most often one I hear, but I don't know if there's any better one.
I really don't think there isn't, in part because first base is a position that generally isn't valued around the league, and he's also such a young free agent. So it's very rare for a guy to reach free agency at his age, at his position, with his pedigree, with his production. Like, he's truly a unique talent. And to some degree, there is some consternation about, you know, putting this much of your future behind a guy who does not offer that much defensive value. Even if he were an unbelievable first baseman, like, there's just so much, you know, there's only so much value you can have at that position. The baseline is very high. You can generally put a guy out there and he'll catch most of the balls. So I don't want to be too dismissive of it, but that's a reality. He's not a shortstop. He's not a center fielder. Those guys are the guys who make the huge money. At the end of the day, I think that they have to be willing to be inefficient with this contract. They have to be willing to say, you know what, maybe Vladdy won this negotiation, but it's worth it because we need this centerpiece, as opposed to being like, we want to fight tooth and nail for every single dollar.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. We'll continue our conversations about the Blue Jays and certainly the Red Sox as well. On the other side, Chris Cotillo from Mass Live will join us. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus, and you're watching it on Sportsnet, listening on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on Sportsnet Television. Sho Ali, Nick Ashbourne here with you. We're here until the top of the hour, here until 12 Eastern. Blake is back on Thursday. Thanks so much for being alongside us. Chris Cotillo from MassLive.com will join us very shortly, we hope. But the Blue Jays looking for a seventh straight win. And this is going to mess me up. Until the winning streak is over, Nick, that's going to really screw with me.
They're going to get it handled for you at some point. I don't think they're going to be undefeated for the rest of the season.
I mean, it's not impossible, but you're probably right. They're probably not going to go undefeated for the rest of the season. Either way, game three of this five-game series goes tonight in Boston on television. It'll be Dan Shulman and Buck Martinez on the Sportsnet Radio Network. It will be Ben Shulman and Chris LaRue. Those are the four voices you will hear on the TV and radio. And Chris Cotillo, Red Sox beat writer for MassLive.com, joins us right now as we discuss the remainder of this series. Chris, how are you?
I'm good, guys. How are you?
We are great. We appreciate you carving out some time for us. Look, I wanted to start certainly by getting to the doubleheader that the Blue Jays swept yesterday at Fenway Park. The defense looked for the Red Sox a little shaky, and you are certainly someone who watches them far more than we do. I am curious, is that a one-off for the Red Sox, or is this something that has kind of plagued them at different times this season?
It's not even a one season off. It's like a 4-year situation. It's crazy. Alex Cora is a guy who made a career and a long, you know, 13, 14 year big league career out of being, you know, a defensive minded guy. And he has pushed his guys to be better. And they haven't. They lead the league in errors. They lead the league in, you know, unearned runs at home. It's been kind of a theme since the beginning. I think you could point to, you know, Trevor Story going down the first couple weeks of the season and reshuffling everything. You know, Sidan Raffaello, who didn't play in the nightcap last night, is a better center fielder than a shortstop. I think they envisioned him there. I think they thought O'Neill would be a little bit better in the outfield. And Story would be able to hold down the fort at short. And they were expecting big things out of Vaughn Grissom at second, and he's barely played the majors. So it's been a year-long issue. It's been something that has plagued them from really early April, you know, very sloppy games. It seems like they come in bunches, and especially at Fenway. So, you know, pitching and defense can win championships. It can also sink the ship. I think that's really been the case. If you look at the lineup, you know, everybody's getting an OPS over 800. You know, they have now with Casas back and Yoshida hitting, like, they've had a pretty good year offensively from a lot of different guys. Abreu stepped up and did the same, but they can't field the ball some nights. And we see, you know, last night and yesterday afternoon how that contributes to some big kind of snowball type innings.
Chris, one thing we know about the Red Sox is that they have a lot of young position player talent. So when we talk about this defense problem, do you think this is a structural issue that you kind of project going forward based on who these guys are? Or do you think this is something that gets solved as the players gain more experience and maybe go to the positions where they're supposed to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just having kind of that solid up the middle force and a guy like Trevor Story, it kind of helped everybody. You know, everybody kind of was playing better defensively at the beginning. You know, last year when he was healthy, he was really solid at the shortstop position. He was great at second base when he played there for the year alongside Bogarts, his first year here. And I think they think there's a trickle down effect. You know, David Hamilton is a guy who has played a lot this year. And he's a guy that I don't think any Red Sox fan expected to have really on the roster. He didn't make the opening day roster, and he's been, you know, a starter either at short or second, you know, every day. And you see, we saw last night with him, you know, a few different things. So, you know, I think part of it is talent. They have guys who are, you know, not projected to be part of their, you know, long-term future on the field. Hamilton, you know, being one. Rafaela, sometimes at short, you know, he's probably a center fielder of the future. And they have a lot of good position players on the rise. They're big three, big four prospects with, you know, the catcher Teal, the outfielder Anthony Campbell, who's kind of a second baseman outfielder, and then Marcelo Meyer, who's hurt, but is a good, you know, shortstop as well. So it's just, like I said, the thing is, being that Cora has focused on it so much. They made a big change, as you guys know, at the end of last year. Carlos Fables was in charge of their infield defense. It just wasn't good enough. And despite him being like Alex Cora's best friend or one of them, they fired him after a long time, and he ended up in Toronto. And that did not cure the issue at all. So it's been, like I said, it's been a theme for a while.
You know, Chris, one of the things we talk about a lot here in Toronto, especially recently, but certainly after the All-Star break, has been the play of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And often a comp for Vladdy in terms of contract situation has been Rafael Devers, in terms of like what Vladdy could in theory get maybe as a starting point. And obviously Vladdy is 25, Devers is going to be 28 soon. He's 27 right now. So it's a very small difference here. But I did want to ask another part of that conversation is, if you're going to give Vladdy a huge contract, if it's going to be 12 years for $350 million, just throwing that out there, let's say that's what it is. I think a large part of the conversation is, how much value does that carry if he's playing at first base and not at third base? Devers obviously is a third baseman. You mentioned Tristan Casas as well. With Casas at first base, do you think there is a chance that at some point in the next 5 years even, that Devers is going to stay at third base, especially with the rise of a lot of the prospects you mentioned? Like, how do you see that playing out for Devers, Casas, and the rise of a lot of these young prospects? Because, I mean, Devers is a phenomenal player, one of the best players in Major League Baseball, but I think he grades out as, like, an average, I think, at best, defensively third baseman.
Yeah, and I think if you watch him every day, it sometimes feels like he's not even at that level. You know, there's sometimes where, you know, the routine play isn't made. You kind of think that, you know, there's still room to grow there. He'll go through stretches where he's excellent. You know, early in his career, he led the league in errors a lot. He's gotten more stable, but at the same time, you know, it's not elite by any means. I think Tristan Casas is a guy who's probably going to be their first baseman for the next, you know, 6 years, and for them, hopefully more, because I think they want to extend him and he wants to be here. And so I look at the DH spot for Devers, really, moving forward. You know, I think that the roster gets a lot more functional if they trade Masataka Yoshida this winter, capitalizing the fact that he's been really, really hot the last few weeks, last couple months. And maybe you start talking about, you know, where everybody fits in there. You know, Marcelo Meyer, Trevor Story, you know, all these guys we've seen, whether it be Rafael, who could play a few different spots, David Hamilton, if he's in the mix, you know, Vaughn Grissom, Campbell, like, there's not spots for all these guys. And if you, you know, were to make one of them a third baseman, move Devers to DH in the next couple of years, I think it does make some sense. You know, guys don't like doing that. It's like taking away the car keys for some of these guys, where they like playing defense. They want to be out there. He takes a lot of pride in his defense, but you know, the guy's going to mash. We've seen that time and time again. I think he's actually an underrated offensive player because, you know, he doesn't have the biggest personality and he kind of just goes about his business, but he has been, you know, unbelievable offensively, and you guys see it whenever they play the Jays, but, you know, just extra base hits all the time. He's put together a monster year this year. You know, last year he didn't ever feel great at the plate and hit 33 homers and had 100 RBIs. This year he's felt great a lot, and those numbers are going to be even better. So, but I see him as the DH long-term. It's kind of what was confusing about, you know, what they're doing with Yoshida, despite the fact he's been great hitting righties the last couple months. Like, He's no longer playing the field because he can't play left, and they've completely taken that away. He can't run, and they're not letting him hit lefties. So he has one, like a half a tool that's really good, and I think they're going to try to trade that somewhere over the winter.
One of the themes of this conversation so far is that surplus of position players the Red Sox seem to have in the present, and then you mentioned those big prospects, and we talked to Alex Speer yesterday about the farm system with the Red Sox and how strong it is and how it seems to focus on these high upper-level position players. And the pitching doesn't seem to be in the same place as an organization. Where do you see the Red Sox getting that pitching? Do you think it's a matter of this team, you know, being a big market team and going on spending in free agency on some top level guys? Or is it going to be a matter of shipping out some of these position players that don't quite fit and trying to address it through that trade route?
Yeah, I mean, I say why not both? I mean, it's hilarious, honestly, because if you look at the Red Sox going into last offseason, starting pitching was far and away the biggest need, the only need. Like, the position player group was in a good spot. The bullpen was in a good spot because Jansen and Martin were both coming back, and they had a bunch of young guys who had stepped up. And you looked at it, and it was just question marks in the rotation. And all they did really was they signed Giolito, who has not pitched because he had, you know, an internal brace, and they traded Sale. So they actually got worse in that regard, which was their biggest need, and they weren't willing to spend. They didn't really get involved on Snell, Montgomery, or some of the guys that traded, whether it be Burns, Cease, whatever. Now, if you look at it and you look at the team, like, the bullpen can always use reinforcements. I think for any team, we've seen that down the stretch with them. Position player-wise, they're, like, more than set at every spot, theoretically. You can always get better. I think, you know, they'd like to add a right-handed bat, maybe, because they're so left-handed. But the starting rotation, again, is such a massive area of need. It was last winter. It was at the trade deadline. It is again. I'm going to start beating the drum that they should just, you know, say screw it and sign Corbin Burns. You know, give him whatever he wants. He's an ace. He's pitched in the American League East this year. We've seen him do, you know, a wonderful job there. I think he'd be perfect. At the same time, you know, the Red Sox have not shown a willingness to play at the top end of the free agent market and go to that, you know, 200, you know, high 200s or 300 for a guy, especially, you know, a pitcher heading into his 30s. I think a guy like Skubal makes a ton of sense. I think Crochet makes some sense. I mean, trading from that surplus, too. You know, they have a lot of those guys. So far, they've been really hesitant to deal anybody with, you know, really blue chip upside. But at a certain point, you know, when your roster and your organization is so imbalanced, you have to. If you look at, you know, the prospect rankings for the Red Sox, all year it's been like their top 20 guys, which includes, you know, probably five top 100 guys, all position players, but their top 20 guys, it's like three pitchers, one or two had Tommy John this year, and 17 position players. It's like, you know, the farm system's ranked really, really high, but it's still extremely deficient in that area because it's so, you know, full of positional guys. Their first round pick at, you know, number 12 overall was Braden Montgomery, an outfielder this year. They haven't drafted a pitcher in the first round since Houck in 2017. They didn't really before this year draft any pitchers in the top 3 to 5 rounds for a while. And you've seen that kind of happen. So, you know, Houck, Bayo, Crawford, and kind of Whitlock, because he was a Rule 5 guy, are homegrown. So they have those guys and they have that talent there. But I think they need to go out and just look at what they did for their 2018 championship team. They traded for Sale. They signed Price to a massive contract, which was at the time the biggest in franchise history. They went out and they flipped Cespedes, who was a position player and a surplus, for Porcello. They, you know, traded for Eduardo Rodriguez. They traded for Evaldi. You know, like, their entire rotation was veterans from elsewhere. And they've been afraid to kind of do that since, largely. And it's really, you know, been an issue for this team for a while. So, yes, Houck, Crawford have taken steps forward, and Bayo's got a ton of talent. But they need that ace. They probably need a left-handed ace because they're all right-handed. They've gotten, like, two starts out of lefties this year, and that was James Paxton before he got hurt. I just feel like it's such a clear area. Burns, Skubal, Crochet, Max Fried, if healthy, like, all those guys should be right at the top of their list, and almost one of them won't be enough.
I feel like, Chris, the what you're laying out is kind of like a, I don't know if it's an ownership thing or if it's a management aspect of it.
Yes, it is.
Ownership? Okay, because it always confuses me because, in theory, the Red Sox, one of the most storied franchises in baseball, should be spending as much money. In a city like Boston, one of the biggest markets in North America, should be spending like the Yankees and like the Dodgers and like the Chicago teams, for example, right? And just when you make a list of the biggest media markets in the world, certainly on this continent, Boston area is at or near the top of the list. And I think it's why it's confusing to see them not hand out large commitments. And I mean, I feel like we've had this conversation in part a bunch of times, even in the last couple of seasons. Even if you put starting pitching aside, I mean, they traded Mookie Betts instead of handing him a big contract. I think there was some consternation as to whether or not they would sign Rafael Devers to the deal. And obviously they did. I think otherwise Red Sox fans would be even more more apoplectic. But why do you think that is? Is it just like the ownership has just decided, hey, we're not opening the pocketbook?
I mean, it's really tough to tell because, you know, John Henry, the principal owner of the team, has not spoken in a press conference setting and been available to questions from the beat, questions from reporters, since the day after they traded Mookie Betts, which was before the pandemic, barely, but it was. That's how long ago we're talking now. I mean, it was February of 2020. And so you get no window into their thinking. They send Sam Kennedy out to really basically, you know, do their bidding, but not really say anything and speak in cliches, and then go back and ask them how he did. It's a bizarre situation. John Henry is not really, if he's at Fenway a lot, which he claims to be, and people say he is, he's not front facing. He doesn't interact with fans. He's completely in the shadows. He's obsessed with his PGA investment. He still has Liverpool, the Penguins. There's talk that they want to buy the Celtics. I think fans for a long time were very concerned that they were getting distracted and were not worried about the Red Sox as the portfolio grew. And for a long time, I said, you know, the more businesses they have, the more money they have, the better for the Red Sox that is. That has not proven to be anywhere close to true, really, over the last couple of years. I think they are, you know, distracted and potentially a little overwhelmed. That's why they, you know, hired Theo Epstein to come back in the fold and really be Red Sox focused again in the shadows, because he doesn't want to overshadow Craig Breslow, but he does work for the club. There just seems to be this, I don't know if it's complacency or whatever it is, but, you know, when you come in and there's an 86-year curse to be broken, you're probably motivated, you're probably driven to do everything you can to break that. And there you go with signing Pedro and Manny Ramirez. And then as time goes on, you love the thrill of winning. And 04 happens and 07 happens. And 13, you kind of run into one. And 18, you build a superstar powerhouse with all these guys from the outside, the guys I mentioned, JD Martinez, all that. At a certain point, maybe it gets boring for them. As ridiculous as that sounds, I think there's a piece of that here, because they've set budgets that are low. They have not tried to compete at that level, and they've tried to maybe win a different way. Maybe that's the interesting part to them, trying to win without spending. But John Henry set a very low budget heading into last offseason, right after his partner, Tom Warner, said, hey, we're going to go full throttle. Those two things didn't line up. Fans are super confused. They still haven't really explained it. And they came out in mid-January after lowballing every free agent on the earth and basically said, actually, we're not going to spend. And Giolito was their big offseason signing. And obviously that, you know, didn't work out for no fault of his. Just his arm finally blew out after being a durable guy for so long. But, you know, the frustration from fans was there. You know, they were able to kind of ward it off for, you know, June and July as they got really hot and looked like a playoff contender. And now, you know, for the third straight year, you know, the fifth time in 6 years, they're collapsing in August and September. And I think the fans are just so sick of it, you know, because the standard here, you know, with what they've built since they took over in 01 or 02 is not, oh, let's see if we can compete for a wild card. And if we get in the dance, you know, it might happen. You know, the standard is you're going to be competing for the division every single time. I think they looked around the AL East and said, we're just not at that place. Why waste the money? And, you know, I think, you know, the Jays have showed, the Rays have showed this year, the Yankees, it stretches that, you know, it's not a guarantee those teams are going to make the playoffs with preseason projections. So, it's a real kind of sad relationship right now between the fans and the owners. I'd like to think that they kind of remedy that by going big this offseason. Again, I think Burns is perfect, but I have my doubts still.
Chris, I don't know how big a basketball fan you are, but if they do end up buying the Celtics, I can only imagine what the Celtics payroll will look like in a couple of years, given that the Celtics, I mean, A, they just won the NBA title, but B, they have, I think, one of the largest payrolls, if not the largest payroll in the NBA. And I think right after they won the title, just signed basically everyone to a whole whack of extensions. And then the owners said, hey, we're selling the team. So I can only imagine what that looks like from a, like a money perspective, actual dollars spent for the Celtics if like the owners of the Red Sox end up buying the team.
Yeah, that's a great, it's a great business model. You hand out hundreds of millions of dollars of somebody else's money and then walk. And while everybody still loves you as Wick Grosbeck, because you just won a title. So that was, you know, I think one of the more shocking things that happened, that he walked away. But he's kind of like, you know, and I think there was a lot of this, you know, while they were making the run, of just like the contrast between, you know, Henry and Grosbeck, and Grosbeck saying, we're going to do whatever we can. It's all about titles. Like, we'll worry about the rest later. Obviously selling the team was what he had to worry about, but being a forward facing owner, a fan, a guy who's there all the time and people really like, you know, he's beloved, even though he's selling the team. John Henry has completely, his reputation's completely flipped over the last five or so years.
I know you touched on this in part in that in the speech there. I think you painted a great picture of where the Red Sox are at, right? In terms of, from Mookie Betts to ownership concerns to not addressing what everyone perceived to be the biggest issue on the team. Now this season, you know, they've seen the playoff odds slide significantly in recent days. Even that doubleheader, I think it was a 7% slide according to the Fangraphs odds. Also booze, you know, raining down at Fenway Park in that game. Could you elaborate a little bit on what the state of the union is between the Red Sox and their fans right now? Because it does seem kind of from an outsider's perspective that there has been this treacherous slope kind of from the Mookie Betts, getting rid of Mookie Betts on down. And we're, you know, we're years out from that now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just, you know, as you guys talked about with the payroll, like, it's unacceptable not to spend at that level when you can, when you have the owners who have proven that they will. But it's also like, you know, the Yankees have this edict in their organization, like, it's just a non-starter to finish below 500. You know, the Red Sox are, you know, they did that in 2020. They were terrible. And then the last 3 years, you know, 78 and 84 and 22, the same record last year. And right now they're back to just three games above 500. You know, they finished in last a couple times. Like, that shouldn't be an option. If the Yankees can find a way where it's not even on the table for them, the Red Sox should do the same thing, I think, just point blank. I think this year is a little bit different because there are so many standout player performances throughout the year where fans can get really excited about some of these, you know, pieces that they have moving forward, you know, where, you know, maybe the hole is not going to make the playoffs, but you look at, you know, like Willy Abreu, who's had a really good first full season in the majors, you lock him in. Jaren Duran is a guy who went from, you know, is he going to make the team to All-Star Game MVP? We saw yesterday, even in the losing efforts, two homers. He's been excellent. You know, Hauk has had a really good year, you know, and he's kind of tailed off in the second half, but he's been good. Crawford's probably a piece of your rotation moving forward. You know, Wong has had a pretty good year. He's sliding now, but a guy that either is a trade chip or, you know, maybe a versatile catcher. Like, there's a lot of pieces around the diamond. Casas, obviously, Rafi, that you can get, you know, excited about. If you're a Red Sox fan, you could see this young core emerging. You know, it was a big deal that they had Hauk and Duran as homegrown all-stars, you know, going to the All-Star game. So that excitement, you know, I think was what carried them through the summer. And they had a lot of guys playing above expectation, which is what this team was going to need to really be a contender. And they were for a while. I mean, if you look at where they were at the All-Star break, they were, you know, at times 11, 12 games above 500. You know, they had closed the gap in the East to only a handful of games with a lot to play. You know, they were aiming for the division. And then the All-Star break came around, and it's been lookout below really since. So they went to LA and get swept. They lost two of three in Colorado, which is embarrassing. And they've been terrible at home. You know, home sweeps against Houston and Arizona yesterday, I think, was a day a lot of people looked at as the schedule is getting theoretically easier, though the Blue Jays are apparently world beaters now. And we'll lose two games to them with Pivetta pitching the way he did, I think, you know, was kind of, you know, if not the final blow, you know, on the way there. And obviously if they, you know, were to lose two of three on the way out here or all three, I think that would be curtains. But, you know, it's kind of happened fast where this, the excitement level was really high because of those guys stepping up. Duran being the All-Star Game MVP was a huge thing. I think he's been kind of the catalyst for the excitement. that was in large part, I think, taken away when he got suspended for directing a homophobic slur at a fan. So it's not been, really since mid-July or the trade deadline, there's not been a lot of fun moments for Red Sox fans, which, you know, May, June, July, or early part of July, like, this team was exciting, fast, athletic, a lot of young guys playing really, really well. Cora was extended, which people loved. And kind of ever since that, it's been, you know, not much good news, which has been, I think, a concerning trend, too, that they've done this in August three straight years.
Game 3 of 5 goes tonight, 7:10 p.m. Eastern, 4:10 p.m. Pacific, on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We'll have that game, Blue Jays and Red Sox, right here on The Fan, certainly elsewhere as well. You can watch it on television with Dan and Buck. We're chatting with Chris Cotillo from MassLive.com. Chris, thank you for spending some time with us. Thanks for being generous with your time. Appreciate it, man. And best of luck with the coverage this season, and we'll do it again.
Yeah, you know, anytime you need some cheery Red Sox thoughts, you can tell I'm your guy.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, man. See ya. There he goes. Chris Cotillo from MassLive.com. Chris, I'm painting a somewhat sobering picture of the Red Sox fan base. It's actually kind of funny, Nick, because it does kind of feel like the vibes for the Red Sox fan base, as you alluded to when you asked him that last question, seem pretty similar to what Blue Jays fans experienced, I will say, up until the All-Star break. I think the vibes since the All-Star break and maybe really since the trade deadline have been vastly different than we experienced, you and I and everyone collectively here at Sportsnet, all the fans, for most of the season. But it almost feels like the two tenors of the seasons for both teams have almost been flipped, essentially.
Yeah, and sometimes we're in a bit of a Blue Jays bubble here. Yeah. We think that we're alone in our misery, but there's misery to be had all over Major League Baseball for plenty of fan bases. And no, the Red Sox are a great example, and it really has been since Betts. And they were good stories, Chris alluded to, for part of the season, but it has been a lot of disappointment for a team that set an incredibly high standard of success for most of the 21st century, to be honest.
I really do think the lack of spending for the Red Sox is what really does genuinely baffle me. And again, like Chris alluded to, it's not a new aspect of conversations we've had about the Red Sox lately, but it's so bizarre to me because even when the Red Sox were like bad, quote unquote, when they were still trying to break the curse and so on, they still spent a fair amount of money. And again, they didn't get there until they did. And then they were all of a sudden winning a whole boatload of games here. But I don't know. It's a bizarre place when a Boston sports team is not spending tons of money, because Boston, as we know, has won, I would say, more than their fair share of titles in our lifetime. Certainly, it's strange to not see the Red Sox be on the same level as the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Cubs, for example, when it comes to going out there and spending ungodly amounts of money.
It's kind of sad. It goes to show that it is a business, right? Like, that is being run like a business. Yeah. And so they have determined that spending X amount of money is going to give them a less of a profit. Like, it's kind of that simple. Whereas a lot of the other owners treat this as sort of a toy, and they're like, yeah, we'll throw money at it and hopefully we get to have a parade and I get to be the hero in town. And I think we all wish that the owners of your team that you cheer for in any sport, any league, would act more like that. But a lot of them act in such a way where they are trying to maximize their profit, and fans do not generally like that as a motivation in their ownership.
I think to your point too, it's why, to bring this back to the Blue Jays, when you get the results the Blue Jays have given you for most of the season, despite actually spending a boatload of cash, like spending a lot of money to get very little actual tangible results, I think is extremely frustrating. And you brought this up earlier in the show, but the Blue Jays, for a good chunk of our lifetime, did not do that, right? Like, they didn't always open up the checkbook and spend tons of cash on free agents. And then all of a sudden, suddenly they're spending big money on Hyunjin Ryu, and they're doing it to George Springer, the biggest contract in franchise history. And you expect they're going to give an even bigger contract to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Like, they have spent the money. And again, I've said this a million times, but they just haven't spent the money wisely. If they did spend the money wisely, then you're probably looking at a much better team. And I think that's why I am so fascinated by what will happen in the offseason. Because again, you have a genuine chance, based partly because of the payroll coming off the books, but also because you offload a bunch of these guys at the trade deadline recently. you know, you have a real genuine chance to rectify some really awful mistakes, right? And I don't want to necessarily call Justin Turner a mistake. I'll even hand up. I thought the IKF deal was a mistake, and he ended up being, in his relatively short tenure as a Blue Jay,
incredible tenure. He got a decent prospect for him. Did great. Yeah, they got a contract worth in, you know, a couple months.
Exactly. Yeah, you were the one who told me this, that he basically outpaced his entire contract in the span, like in terms of production on the field, in the span of a very short time. I am kind of sad that my pseudo-bold prediction of him getting to double-digit home runs as a Blue Jay now cannot come true because he got traded before that could happen. But at least, Nick, when it comes to the Blue Jays, I think you, whether it's, and again, Juan Soto is a pipe dream, although I do think they will at least, like, there'll be a phone call. There might even be an offer, but, you know, truly he's probably going to end up in with one of the two New York teams. He might end up with the Mets for the same reason we're talking about. The owner wants to be the hero and spend tons of money and spread the cash around. I wouldn't be shocked if Cohen does that for the Mets, but or Steinbrenner does it for the Yankees. But beyond Juan Soto even, if you go out into the free agent world and get back two really good bats in the form of like an Alex Bregman or a Willy Adames or an Adames and a Santander or a Teo and a Tyler O'Neill. Like there are a number of ways you can solve that problem. But if you do that, you have a real chance of at least pushing for a third wildcard spot next year, which they have said all along that's their plan.
Well, one of the reasons this front office keeps promising this sustained success, like that has been what they've talked about a lot. And one of the reasons why fans are so upset with them is because it hasn't happened. But one of the reasons that they promised that is because they have the backing from ownership to spend amounts of money that would be absolutely insane to us. You know, when we were kids and looking at the early 2000s Blue Jays, where they were very reluctant to keep, you know, even keep their stars, this is a whole different era in Blue Jays baseball, but it has to take place on the field as well. Like it's taking place in the boardroom and the support is there from ownership, but you have to take that money, as you said, you have to allocate it wisely. You still have to build a good baseball team. Having a lot of money is no guarantee of success, but it is a very useful tool to get you there.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network, watching on Sportsnet. Let's take a quick break, Nick. And when we come back, let's go to the text line, 590-590, name and location. I see a whole whack of text here. Certainly take your text. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. I see some good ones about if I was a GM for a day, this is what I would do. Here are some free agent moves I'd like to see. You can certainly keep them coming. 590-590, name and location. We'll be right back. That's Nick. I'm Sho on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Final segment of the program here on Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Jays Talk Plus with Sho and Nick here with you. We're here until the top of the hour. We're back tomorrow one last time. Blake Murphy is back on Thursday. Hope he's getting a well-deserved rest. Although, as I understand it, he's living the good life. So, Godspeed, Blake. Hoping to see you on Thursday. I wanted to get to some texts. 590-590. Name and location. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. That is, as I like to call it, the people's text line. And Nick, the people's text line is always open, so you can certainly text this radio station anytime you like. Again, 590-590, name and location. It is a text from Sean in Campbell River, British Columbia. Sean on the West Coast, thanks for being with us, man. He says, or he asks, Stuart Baroa doesn't seem to bring a ton besides speed and good vibes so far. When might we see Alan Roden get a look? It's true, there was a clip. Was it last night of him? I actually saw it on this Blue Jays social media, on like they're on at Blue Jays on X, but it was a clip of Baroa singing Sweet Caroline, which was kind of funny, and he was like conducting the rest of the Blue Jays dugout. But it's true, like from an actual production standpoint, despite the fact that he is apparently very well liked in that clubhouse, he does not necessarily provide a lot of production beyond a little bit of speed on the base paths and when he fills in right field for Springer on DH days. Alan Roden, I think there is a chance we see Alan Roden before the end of the season, maybe even as soon as rosters expand in a couple of days when September hits here, Nick. But at the same time, I do wonder if the prospects you'll see first might be like a Jonathan Clase, maybe even a Nathan Lucas, because he might not even be in the organization next year and he's a little older. I think he's either 30 or he's almost 30. So I tend to think those are the guys you'd see before Roden, but as far as I'm aware, even going back to the spring, and I remember hearing this from Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, that Alan Roden is someone that the organization has been very impressed with. So I can't imagine he's never going to get a look, but I think you'll see guys like Klaas A and Lucas probably before him.
Yeah, I think Roden is someone they still want to see more at AAA, right? He has less than 200 plate appearances at that level. He's someone who's moved, you know, relatively slowly over the last couple of years. You know, he had two looks at AA. So he's someone who has to prove it, right? He's not a huge, big, toolsy guy. He's someone who has to produce. His game is more about, you know, hitting line drives, having good plate discipline. He's more of a corner outfielder as well. Guys with that profile, it's a little bit like Will Wagner, to be honest.
Sure.
They have to keep producing in order to earn the organization's trust. And I think what Stuart Baroa, the person who texted, is absolutely right. Like, he does not provide on-field value for the Toronto Blue Jays, but that's part of the idea, I believe, because they have so many guys they're trying to get at-bats to right now that having someone else who they also feel obligated to evaluate would be difficult. It'd be difficult to cram everyone into the lineup. So when you have a Baroa there, you can kind of leave him on the shelf to do his vibes thing and then occasionally bring him out to pinch run or defensive replacement or, you know, as you say, the odd day where Springer wants to DH. It's weird to say that Baroa has value by not having value, but he kind of does in terms of how this roster works on a day-to-day basis. Roden's someone who's still interesting, absolutely. I wouldn't be shocked if we see him. Klaas A, as you mentioned, someone you might see as well. Even if he didn't play a ton, he would give you value on the bases in the outfield too. But Baroa, yeah, it's weird, but he has a niche role with the Blue Jays, and he sort of fills that role perfectly in terms of what they need right now at this particular moment. I think he's a little bit lucky to be in the big leagues, and I'm not sure he's a big league caliber player, but you know, the vibes are part of that. Being able to play a little defense is part of that. And yeah, it's been a nice little run for him for most of the season, being a young and exciting Bradley Zimmer type.
It's true. It is very comparable to Bradley Zimmer. I don't know how many vibes Bradley Zimmer was bringing. I freely admit, but
they were in secret. Yeah. They were not outward vibes.
Hey, look, that year I saw with my own eyes Bradley Zimmer hit a home run. I saw this happened as the Blue Jays. So no one can ever take that away from him. I do wonder with Baroa though, because I did mention that there's a chance that, you know, Springer's DH and he could play in right field. But another guy who fits that bill is Addison Barger. And I think if you're talking about guys you want to see more from between now and the end of the regular season, I mean, you want to see more from Addison Barger. And I mean, we're talking to Ben Nicholson-Smith earlier. Maybe Barger gets flipped in the offseason. It's just right now there is a bit of a logjam in terms of getting a lot of these younger guys who you don't know as much about as much playing time as humanly possible. Like, I don't know where you are on this. I think I would take Horwitz out of that equation, and I would take Clement out of the equation, because A, they're a teensy bit older, but I think we've also seen them for long enough. I mean, Horwitz made his major league debut last year, even if it was for much less, much less of a length of time. But they're also, I think, have done enough to solidify their space on next year's roster. So if you take them out of the equation in the sense that we kind of know what they're about, and you just want to see how well they do and pitchers adjust to them or readjust to them, however you want to phrase it, really then it becomes about the Bargers of the world. And I would think David Schneider has unfortunately played himself back into being in that conversation. Baroa is certainly a part of that. Will Wagner and Lo Perfido are a part of that. Like, those are the guys we're really talking about, right? So I think that's why, when it comes to Baroa's spot amidst all of that, it's just kind of hard to really parcel out playing time for him, like, on a really consistent basis.
Yeah, you're talking about those audition-type guys. That's almost half of a lineup, right? Wagner,
sure, yeah.
Lo Perfido, Leo Jimenez would also go in that bucket. Barger, that's four guys right there. Davis Schneider, potentially. Like, it is hard to find room for these guys, and you want to value them at AAA too, if you think highly of them, right? There are guys that you don't care whether they're really getting at bats or not. Again, Baroa probably figuring into that sort of mix. But if they're someone you regard highly enough that you want to make sure they are playing every day so you can watch all these at bats they're taking, it is difficult to do that. I mean, there's only so many spots in the lineup, and you're going to keep rolling with Vladdy and Springer and Kirk. You know, those are three spots that are pretty much done, Varsho as well. So it is very difficult on a day-to-day basis to make all of this work. And they still need a lot of evaluation with these guys. They still don't really know what they have. Even, you know, Addison Barger, for instance, brutal in his first two looks with the Blue Jays,
right,
at the plate, like, really looked lost. And he's come back since, and he started doing kind of what you figured he'd do. He starts hitting for power. Since he's come back to the big leagues late July, he's slugging .514.
Ooh.
That's nice. But on the flip side, three walks against 21 strikeouts in that time as well. So there's still that worry about his play discipline. Does it play? Like, you need more times these guys to know. Lo Perfido, when he first showed up, really, really tough time at the plate. Looked lost, struck out all the time. last couple of weeks, he's been one of their best offensive players. He's been stroking it for extra bases on a consistent basis as well. Like, he's looking like he's got speed and power. That's a compelling player. You just don't know. And even by the end of the season, to be honest, we won't know. Like, sure. We'll still need more time to understand who these guys are.
I see a text here from Mark. Mark from Thorold. Mark texts pretty often. Mark, we appreciate it. Mark says, nobody's mentioned this before, but how about a configuration that sees George Springer at first base, Vladdy at third, and you go to Santander for right field? That way you're dealing with the money in-house that you're already paying for in Springer. You use that money to get a closer that you don't waste on Pete Alonso or whoever at first base. You just put Springer there. I would have a hard time seeing George Springer at first base. And also, I can't help but wonder if it might not be like a waste to put George Springer at first base, because I think the big part of it too is, I think you can get by with one of your corner outfielder spots next year being a slightly less defensive premium of a player if the other two spots are Varsho and Springer. You know what I mean? Like, I think you can get by because those guys provide you with great value defensively. Whereas, like, if you're putting Springer at first base, he's obviously a phenomenal player. He'd probably be fine at third base. He'd probably be really good at first base, if we're being honest. But I think you'd probably get better value for your money because you're already paying him a ton of cash to just leave him in right field. I actually wouldn't be surprised, though, kind of along the same lines of Mark's question, Nick, to see maybe even Springer flip to left field if you wanted to go after a different right fielder. I'm not saying that's possible. I'm just saying, like, that could be. I feel like that's more in the realm of possibility: Springer in left versus Springer at first base.
There's been so much talk about Springer's physical decline because his offense has declined. Right. But in terms of defense, he's played a pretty good right field this season. And you know, look at his sprint speed right now in the 74th percentile league-wide. Like, if you look at his speed or the defensive metrics, he'd grades better than Santander out there. So if anything, you'd put him at first base over Springer. Like, Springer, again, he's not a Gold Glove winner at this point in his career, but he still is a really good athlete. He always has been. And sometimes those guys who are great athletes have a way of aging a little bit more gracefully, and that hasn't necessarily happened on the offensive side of the ball, but it has happened on defense. So, yeah, there's lots of different configurations you can work up when you're thinking of your free agent targets, but I don't think getting Springer into the infield or getting him out of his spot is a priority. I think he's absolutely fine in right field.
There's a text here, 590-590, name and location. Adam in Toronto had texted in about, like, what will be in the future. This is lots of Blue Jays specific text and more just like a general baseball text, but I like those too. And Adam basically was wondering, he says, there's going to be a hard salary cap implemented on the league in the not too distant future, because the CBA is up for negotiation. I believe it's at the end of the 2026 season. I think it is, Nick? And if that's the case, and it's not that long ago that we went through a bit of CBA negotiations, just a couple seasons ago when the season started, I think just a little into April, we lost about like 10 days of the season before they came to an agreement. And I remember thinking, like, gosh, I'm really going to get a lockout? And I guess they did for like a very brief period of time. I do wonder about the idea of a hard salary cap in Major League Baseball. I can't help but think if that's where owners are going to dig in their heels on, I can't help but wonder what possible concessions players would have to extract from them. But I kind of wonder, like, are there any concessions players can extract from owners to agree to a hard salary cap? Because I just can't imagine there are many that would make it super appealing for players if it means that there's less money to go around.
Yeah, this is the ultimate draw the line issue for the players, right? Like, all the other major sports in North America have some kind of salary cap. Some are harder, some are softer. You could argue in baseball the competitive balance tax works a bit salary cap.
And the
anyway.
Blue Jays kind of treated it like one.
And a lot of teams do. And I'm not saying that's a good thing. Like, I'd like to see more money flow to the players, but that's the reality. A lot of teams do treat it that way. And so if you're the owners, you can kind of maybe massage the competitive balance tax to some degree, kind of make it more difficult for teams to go over. I think that's the angle they'd use, because the reality is that not having a salary cap is the greatest victory the players union has had. And it's what sets them apart from other similar unions in North America. And walking back from that would be such an enormous loss that there'd just be no way to spin it. Like, normally when you have these negotiations, both sides have to be able to come out and say, oh, well, we're disappointed about X, but we got Y.
Right, right.
Where if you're the players union and you say, we're disappointed that the one thing that has made us special for decades is now over, like, what is the Y that you're getting on the other side of that? It's pretty hard to imagine. So the players will fight tooth and nail to prevent that from happening. Maybe there's a world where they get locked out for an amount of time where that's something they consider falling back on, but it would be absolute desperation that would lead them to that point.
I think you're right. I can't see a world. And hey, don't get me wrong. I am certain the owners, or at least some of them, will push for it. I'm certain they will. But
they'd love it. They'd absolutely love to have a salary cap. There's
but
no question.
I just can't help but think that the people on which the labor of the MLB is provided, i.e. the players, I can't imagine they're going to agree to it. I just don't see a world in which that happens. And even if it means for them, and which would suck for us and for the fans, if there was no baseball, because I have no idea what we would talk about or what Blair and Barker would talk about or what Blake would talk about. But
it's a tough summer. Yeah, it's a tough summer with no baseball.
This summer was already tough enough, and we still had the Olympics. And now that's done, right? So I do wonder what would happen. Hey, by the way, the Paralympics start tomorrow. Don't forget. I did want to read one more text before we get out of here. 590, 590, name and location. And certainly if more come in, we can read those as well. Hey, JStock Plus, if I was GM for a day, this is what I would do. This is from Ennio in Richmond Hill. So Ennio says, one, I would sign Vladdy to a 10-year, $300 million deal. I would trade Bo to the Dodgers. I would leverage their farm system for some pitching. Three, I would sign a big bat at free agency, probably two, i.e. Santander and or Teoscar Hernandez. And four, I would add to the bullpen. I will respectfully say number four, add to the bullpen, should be really viewed as build a bullpen from scratch. If you're talking about the bullpen, to work backwards from Ennio's points, if you're talking about the bullpen, Nick, for 2025, I mean, what spots really are locked down for the 2025 bullpen? I would say beyond Chad Green, only because he is under contract for next year. There might not be that many, like probably Jordan Romano, because the report is that he's going to pitch at least a little bit before the end of the year. He's not a free agent next year. He will be after next year. And I don't know that he's like necessarily like earned a locked down closer spot because of the injuries, but he's probably at least on the team next year in a relatively high leverage spot just because we've seen what he can do in the past, and this year is kind of a wash because of all the injuries. So let's say Green and Romano, Yenesis Cabrera, probably.
Yeah, Cabrera will be there. I think that
maybe Swanson.
Swanson, how he performs down the stretch could play a role. Like if he looks really busted down the stretch and they have to reevaluate, but I think the plan would be to have him there. And the other guy I'd throw into the mix would be Brennan Little.
All right.
Because it's tough to get, you know, a more cost-effective lefty. He can get you ground balls. Like, he is sort of what Tim Mesa was. He's not at that level at all. Like, Mesa was a very accomplished veteran reliever, but that is the idea of what he could be. And going to get someone with that talent will cost them money. I think they'll just stay with the cheap option in-house. But then, you know, those guys could also not be healthy necessarily. Like, sure. I laid out five as kind of like, this is the maximum you'd feel good about. One or two of those guys go down in spring, like you're in serious issue. So yeah, when you say build it from scratch, I don't know if we're quite there, but you're building from a flimsy foundation, that's for sure.
And don't get me wrong, like I think there are roles for player. I mean, we talked about Ryan Yarbrough before. If he wants to come back, he would almost assuredly, he's not going to be a starter, so he'd almost assuredly be, or at least I would be surprised if he's a starter, but he'd almost assuredly be in a team's bullpen. So let's just say he's in the Blue Jays bullpen next year. That's certainly possible. Maybe Yariel Rodriguez is in the bullpen next year. Who knows? We have to see how he acquits himself down the stretch because, you know, all things considered, he had a pretty good start. He had some great starts, certainly the beginning of July. And then I think since then, it's been a little spotty in terms of length, in terms of command, certainly in terms of the velo has certainly been there. And he has a starter's arsenal worth of pitches. But I do wonder what that looks like when it looks like the starting job for next season. So maybe that's still a bit of a question mark, although I tend to hope at least that he ends up being a starter given his contract. But maybe he's a bullpen player as well. But I mean, there are spots for guys like Ryan Burr and Tommy Nance, for example, on next year's bullpen. It just, they can't be very high leverage spots. If you're talking about like a bullpen of 10 to 12 guys, they're probably like the 9th to 12th guys. You know what I mean? Like they're at the very end of the bullpen. Like there are spots for those kinds of guys. You're not going to have every pitcher in your bullpen be high leverage, but I do wonder how much more they have to do in order to like cement any kind of spot. And the truth might simply be that's not going to happen until the offseason.
I don't know if there's anything, say, a Tommy Nance can do, unless, I don't know, he pitched purely scoreless innings right from here on out, but this is a guy who's out of options as well, so that makes a big difference. Like, Burr has options, so that could keep him in the organization. If you were planning around either of those guys, like, going into the offseason, you're on your whiteboard, and you're like, who's where, and you're drawing arrows and depth charts, and either Burr or Nance are, like, firmly in the plans, you're not making a very good plan. I think that's the reality.
The other part of Ennio's text, he said, sign Vladdy to a 10-year, $300 million-plus deal. I tend to think at this point it's going to be far north of that in terms of both years and
Plus
dollars.
The Plus is doing some work. Plus is doing work there.
It's doing some heavy lifting, that's for sure. I think Bo to the Dodgers, that's a tough one because, you know, they could certainly use more shortstop help because they've kind of moved guys around. Gavin Lux hasn't panned out the way they want. So I could certainly see that being the case, and the Dodgers certainly have a wealth of minor league pitching and prospects or position players from their prospect pool that would certainly enrich the Blue Jays own. And the Dodgers have always been that way because they're the Dodgers, if we're being honest. But I do find it hard to really forecast where Bo is going to go. But of course, there was that report from a couple weeks ago from, again, Bob Nightingale of USA Today that the Blue Jays are going to explore trading Bo in the offseason. I do want to ask you actually, Nick, before we go, does Bo need to play in order to rehabilitate some of his value if they are going to trade him in the offseason, or do you think it doesn't really matter?
It would definitely be helpful, right? Like, I think if a team is looking at acquiring him to be their starting shortstop for a season, you know, that's a premium position, and they'd be having to pay, you know, for a starting caliber shortstop, maybe even more than that on the trade market. And we're just saying, you know what, it was a lost year, don't worry about it. Bo Bichette's still good, trust me. Like, that's tough. It's tough to pay for him at that level. So I think it would do him a lot of good if his goal is to get out of town, or do the Blue Jays a lot of good if their goal is to trade him, for him to come back and look approximately like Bo Bichette, even for a couple weeks here. Is that the absolute difference? No, I think it's a factor, not the factor.
Speaking of which, Bo, there's a good chance Bo does at least start some base running today at Fenway Park. He was reportedly said to have joined the team in Boston, and there's a chance he could be with the team or be in Buffalo for a rehab assignment on the weekend. So we might not be that far away from seeing Bo Bichette, Nick, in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, I mean, if you count watching him run the bases before the game and seeing Bo Bichette, yeah, we'll see him. No, I think that, again, it's in everyone's interest for him to get back with the team. It might steal some at-bats from some of the younger players, but at the end of the day, whether you're keeping Bo longer term or shorter term, or you're trading him, you want to know what you have in the player, and that will be helpful for him to get back on the field.
Before we go, a reminder that game 3 of this 5-game series in Boston goes tonight, 7:10 p.m. Eastern, 4:10 p.m. Pacific. Dan Shulman, Buck Martinez will be on the call on television and on the Sportsnet Radio Network. It'll be Ben Shulman and Chris LaRue. Blair and Barker have their regular show to get you set later today at 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern, and they'll have Jay's Talk Classic, let's call it, afterwards as well. Thanks to Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thanks to Chris Cotillo. Thanks to Jen Rolnick, Austin Mackey, and Amit Mann. For Nick Ashbourne, I'm Sho Ali. We're back tomorrow with more Jay's Talk Plus. Talk to you later.